Yeah.
Sort of a weird convention. It's sort of an inconvenience, like with like women in academia who have to do it. Language descent, but it doesn't work like at all, and that's so usually what people do in, especially in Indo-European linguistics, you use what's usually called like wave theory of language change, and the idea is basically, so here's a good old Black Sea, here's Turkey, here's Greece, Italy, blah blah blah, doesn't matter. So up here you have the Indo-Europeans, and they're living, thousands of years ago. And the idea is basically what you really have is not necessarily linear descent. It's not like tribes are splitting or whatever, and they go different ways. It's that like there's an entire sprachbund, there's an entire community of languages that are sort of similar to each other. And phonetic changes might come from one point here or another point here, but they like gradually spread, over the language community. So you'll sort of have them like in different, you don't have any boundaries like this because, let's say Germanic, Indo-Aryan, and Romance might share some common feature that Slavic doesn't have. Or maybe Germanic, Indo-Aryan, and Slavic have something Romance doesn't have or something like that. So this is why. So as I said, Hittite is definitely like the first language to split off. So Hittite is clearly different from everything else, or Anatolian, of course. But apart from that, everything else is sort of like, there's no tree we can draw from. Well, you can sort of say Tocharian was the second one off. But even that's tangential. Everything else is sort of, must have been part of the sort of language community where changes are happening in waves. So that's like the point, that's the conceptual point. so that was the last liquidum. So does it, I don't know, anyone? So I guess like the handout has shit on Hittite and like basically the Indo-European morphological system, which is relatively simple, so we can probably just run through it super fast. And of course stuff on ablaut and ringtails. So ablaut is basically the standard morphological system of Indo-European. So as I said last time, every Indo-European root can be summed up to something like that, or at least nowadays, every Indo-European root is consonant, resonant, and a vowel, resonant, consonant. And the prime morphological, you have suffixation or stuff, but the main non-concatenative part of Indo-European morphology is that this e can vary with different sounds. So in some situations it becomes o, in some situations it disappears, and rarer situations it becomes elongated e or elongated o. I think I put the example there. So you have a Latin word like tegere, which means like to cover, and then you get denominal forms from that, which are ogre, like toga. So toga is something that covers. And so the English. Yeah, I guess there's one very good English example of all five of these, and it's sit. So Indo-European has a root, which is something like S-E-D, and this means sit. You have an egre, this gives us the word sit. You have the ogre gives you, so sar becomes sat in English, so that's really the past tense. And basically, Germanic conserves this very productive ablaut pattern in past tense. That's where it comes from. And you also have, so long form gives you seat. So you want it there. And then you have sod, or sit, so. And then my favorite one, the best one is, of course, if you put zero grade, so there's, the vowel is totally eliminated, and you have a prefix that means something like under. This becomes nest in English.
Nice.
So that's ablaut, and it's the prefix means under. So this is related to the word like nether. So it's the same prefix here. It's like under. In Proto-Germanic, I don't know if it can be traced all the way back to Indo-European, but so this is where basically all of the vowel irregularities in Indo-European come from. They come from e or o or zero, and you can have long and short varieties of all of them. And the thing about this is that there's no perfect conditioning environment that goes with it. We'll talk later, there are some correlations of it, so like schwa, So this is called the full grade when you have F. This is called the zero grade. And then these are called extended grades or something like that. If you have the zero grade, you basically never have stress on that syllable. Or, a good example is, so, like the Indo-European copula is a good example. So like in a language like Latin, you have, or any Indo-European language, you know, est, which means is, and you have like sunt, and of course this relates to Old English syndrome, so these are the same thing, so this is R. And historically in Indo-European, you have one root that's S, and this comes from, and it's regular, you have S, so these are just irregular endings. But when you take this in, when you're talking about athematic verbs, the stress actually changes in the latter one. So you'll hear, this will become a zero grade, and you'll have stress over here. This becomes, basically SD, this becomes something like SNT or something like that. you get variations like this all over the place. But the point is, so a lot of these sort of correlate with certain kinetic factors, but we haven't been able to work out totally where they come from. So it's just like one of those leftover parts of morphology that we haven't quite understood. So same thing on the second page. So you have stuff like English sing, sang, and sung. Those are just reflexes of a grade, o grade, and zero grade. So sung is just like historically a zero grade. So that's where all that comes from. So obviously this is really still productive in Germanic languages, and it's still productive in, well, I mean, it's not productive in Latin because Latin's dead. But you know, early Indo-European languages have a lot of this. And I put Greek examples because Greek has really conserved vowels. So you have patera, which is e grade, that's just accusative, pater. I mixed some of this up.
What does the top part do and what does the start part do?
What was that?
So the pa and the ter have different meaning, right?
No, they're one morpheme together, but it's just we're looking, like in an individual syllable, you can have this alternation. Although in that situation, people have said that tear might actually have an independent meaning because you have it in the word for mother and, you know, brother and different stuff. But, you know, it's not tear.
Yeah, some of our mixed around mold, I think patros should be the zero grade.
Yeah, I moved a couple of these around or something. So.
I see what's intended.
Okay, good. So, yeah, that's that. So, again, everyone knew that there was this ablaut system in Proto-Indo-European or something like that. But there used to be another alternation, and that's in the laryngeal section. And people noticed that there was a variation between what's reconstructed as a schwa. And this schwa could appear as a long a, as a long ah, or a long o in different situations. So, if you look at the Greek, Sanskrit, and Latin examples, you have basically, so you have de, which is a place, and in each situation, you can have a long vowel, like a long e, well in Sanskrit, I should say, in Sanskrit, a, e, and o all merge together, so in Sanskrit it appears as an a, but it's, you know, it can be traced to an m. So in the first form you have long e, and then you have other sounds in the other forms, which, you know, in Greek you have e, Sanskrit I, and Latin a. In Sanskrit, I and Latin a are basically epimphetic, that's why they're sort of traced back to being schwas. So these symbolize that Indo-European schwa, and then you have long vowels, and that's what you have in, you know, the sta and do as well. So this is the old interpretation of everything. So the problem was, there are two main problems. One is that Greek has three different, like, even though Latin and Sanskrit have one vowel, like Latin always has a, and Sanskrit always has I, Greek has a different vowel in every single position. And the idea was that Greek had a kind of paradigmatic leveling, like Greek people just said, oh, there should be an e here because there's an e in other situations. Which is sort of a bad explanation, because it happens all over Greek. So Saussure said that's sort of a bad idea. And you can actually account for these variations in the same terms that you account for ablaut, by assuming that you have this variation of, you know, e with o with zero, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea was, Saussure wanted to say, okay, what this is really just a certain form of this. So there are these two ablaut systems, and he wanted to unify them. So this is what laryngeal theory is about. So basically what Saussure said is that instead of having a schwa, he says, get rid of this. What you really have is that, you have your roots here, there. His argument was, instead of having these as the roots, what you really have is you have these, what he called coefficients sonantiques, or what we called laryngeals. His idea was you really have this sort of hidden, you have an egg ray with a hidden consonant in it. So his point was basically. So in all of these situations, what the extended braid is, like these longer forms here, result from compensatory lengthening. So again, you lose these sounds and the vowels widen. And of course, you have laryngeal coloring as well. So again, he made the argument based on Semitic languages and other languages like that, that these two sounds will change the vowel quality of M. So again, he's sort of trying to take all of these and say, oh, this is really just an extraneous circumstance of everything else. So it's really just an ablaut quality. And his argument came from things like the Greek on the first page. So for example, you have, again, so you can have a root like C, R, eta, R, C. And then you have a root that goes something like this. So this is a vowel. You have ya as a, resonant. And so in Greek, you have words like lepo, which descends from this qua becomes p in Greek. And you can have an o grade, so you can have, so loik becomes loipa, so you have the same vowels here. And then when you have a zero grade, something like this will become syllabified into lip, so you have ended bone. So his point was, in the same way that these things become syllabified, what actually is happening here is that in some situations you have a zero grade. So in some situations you have the lengthen of this because of compensatory lengthening, so this changes to ah, and that drops off, right, and becomes sa in the descendant. But in some situations, you have a zero grade, where all you have is st, and this will become syllabified in the same way that a ya will become syllabified in those situations. So the end result is basically, first off, it makes sense of the Greek data, but it also puts you in a position where you can explain this more complicated alternation in terms of one that already obviously existed. When you reconstruct it, you're assuming that the Proto-Indo-European does not yet have the vowel coloring and the compensatory lengthening. Basically, it's if you look at it synchronically, it would look like something like this. So you have Indo-European, Proto-Indo-European, and then here's your daughter families. So at some point in time, you have vowel coloring. At some point, you'll have laryngeal loss, which causes compensatory lengthening. And remember, Hittite and Anatolian languages still have some laryngeals, so they basically split off at this point or something like that. But yeah, the Indo-European we reconstruct does not have vowel coloring, it does not have laryngeal loss. So you will reconstruct, so this is the word for place, dek. You don't, and this is the word for, what is it, give. It has an M on the O, even though it will be colored into the O.
So we guess that these things also happen actually while these languages were just one language, right?
Yeah, because they all show, they all do the same thing, basically. They had split off a lot earlier, it'd be really weird if they all lost the same consonants or something like that. So it seems plausible. And laryngeal loss obviously didn't all happen at the same time because Hittite loses some laryngeals and doesn't lose all of them. are a couple situations. So I didn't put this here, but this isn't the only reason we have laryngeals. So they actually show up everywhere else. Like I said last time, so Sanskrit. So Indo-European has pa, ba, and pa. So Sanskrit also has like pa, aspirate pa. And these aspirates seem to come from contact with the laryngeal or something like that. Or in Germanic languages, you have trimoraic vowels in Proto-Germanic, and that seems to have come from laryngeal contact. Like, so this is the main reason laryngeals were posited, but it was sort of a boon for the entire field because they solved like 100 little problems that were here and there.
So the aspirated stops are remnants of the laryngeals, not the aspirated consonants of Proto-European.
Well, these Sanskrit buzz, they come from Indo-European, but these usually come from laryngeal contact.
Oh, okay,
they
so
come from different things. And Sanskrit itself is a really interesting language. Obviously, they have like retroflex sounds and stuff, which are partially borrowed from Dravidian languages and things like that. Sanskrit phonology, a bunch of weird stuff happens in Sanskrit phonology itself. Existed when?
I thought they were added to like Hindi in later stages. I didn't know they existed in Sanskrit as well.
Oh yeah, they exist in the earliest forms of Sanskrit. And sometimes it's an interesting story. So sometimes they are just borrowed from other languages, and you know, borrowings from Dravidian languages will have them. Also, so the Sanskrit R was retroflex, and one of the phonological rules is that whenever R comes in contact with a T, it becomes retroflex. So historically, they were probably allophones of each, like dentals and retroflexes were allophones of each other, but probably contact with other languages made them phonemically distinct. And they're definitely phonemically distinct at the earliest form that we have Sanskrit, to my understanding at least. So. And the other sort of theoretical thing that's nice about laryngeals is, so this used to be the form you reconstructed for a place, so dead. But once laryngeals came into being, you could have this, where you have like the CRVC structure. So earlier people had realized this is usually what you have, but there are weird exceptions like these, and laryngeal theory takes care of them. So that's another plus of it. It just sort of makes them, it brings up the say this before, but you can't have S's at the beginning of in addition to the consonant, so you can't have ste, even though you're supposed to only have one consonant. I mean, it's the same way in English, like S's are a little weird, you know, they seem to interact in weird ways, like they're not really, they don't really fit into consonant structure, you know. But. Okay. So the verb.
So before laryngeals, these were analyzed as just the consonant followed by vowel without anything at the end.
Yeah.
And that didn't fit into
it. Yeah, it'd be like a long vowel. So if you constructed how I had it on the page before, I think. Yeah. We have de, sta, and do. Okay, so morphology. So morphology is an interesting. It's an interesting point because we know actually a lot about how the Indo-European verbal system and nominal system generally worked, in that we know very well what tenses are. There, and in fact, even though the meanings of the tenses have changed a lot, we sort of know in what direction they've changed. So just as a phonological point, there are two sort of conjugations in Indo-European. There are what's called thematic verbs and athematic verbs, which are pretty much what you would expect. thematic verbs. So usually you'll have, you know, your stem or your root, and you'll have an ending. The only difference is thematic verbs will take an A or an O, some kind of thematic vowel, an ablauting vowel, and that's the only difference. So athematic verbs are, you know, things like hess, so be. Basic words in the language, athematic verbs are definitely original to the language, in that, well, they're more archaic and stuff like that. Also, they exhibit ablaut, so you will get zero grades of this, stuff like that. But in thematic verbs, which are more common, so like the word for bear or something like that, this is a thematic verb, so it'll take a thematic ending, and it doesn't show ablaut. So that's the main difference. In addition, the only athematic verbs will show ablaut. Thematic verbs don't. And that's sort of a testament to the oldness of, you know, athematic verbs. They're older, they do weird things like ablaut. I guess on page 4 there's a brief... Yeah.
The ending directly attached to S verb without any vowels.
Yeah, if it's athematic, you don't have, it just goes straight on. There's an example on page 4. So you have, on left is the word for be, so it's just, you know, your standard 6 person and number conjugation. And then you have the thematic vowel, or a thematic verb, so that's the word for bear. And I included the duals. Indo-European definitely has duals, but their reconstructions are sort of ambiguous. So I didn't include one for the athematic one because it's a really sort of questionable. But the distinction, okay, so there are a couple things to note about these. So as again I said, the athematic verbs show ablaut in that the plural forms will have zero grade. So there's no vowel in the root whatsoever. It's just smi, ste, santi. That's all you have. You won't have that in thematic verbs. That's one. Difference two is, of course, thematic verbs have thematic vowels, and if you notice, they are A and O, and A and O appear in different, systematically different places. And this is one of the things that gives you sort of a clue as to how funnel or phonetically they might have arisen. So O precedes a resonant, so you have it before H, you have it before W, you have it before N. And then E precedes a non-resonant, like T or S or something like that. So there seems to be sort of a phonetic conditioning behind all of them. But that's just circumstantial. You can't make that claim about everything in the language, but it works at least for the personal endings. So then there are tenses and aspects. So the thing, tense and aspect is in one category because like no one really knows what's a tense and what's an aspect or whatever. We can put it in terms, there are a lot of little things here, but we can put it in terms of the oldest forms of Indo-European. In the oldest forms of Indo-European, you had what was called, or pre- and proto-Indo-European, you had basically what is the imperfect tense. So you would just have the root, and then you put a thematic vowel if you needed it, and then you put an ending. And that was your one tense that you had, basically. It's all that existed. What happens later is that you form a different present tense. And that happens by adding on a different affix, which is usually E. So in Indo-European, I have a chart there of primary and secondary endings. So what those mean is secondary endings are for past tenses, like imperfect, for aorist, stuff like that. Primary endings are for present and future. And the nomenclature is sort of backwards, actually, because the secondary endings are actually primary in terms of they were the first ones. The primary endings, on the other hand, are derived from the secondary endings, if that makes sense. So you take the secondary endings, and in certain persons, you add on E. So in the singular, you'll add on E. In the third plural, you add on E. So that's really the only difference between the two of them. And then, so at this point, so you have basically two tenses. You have imperfect, which just has an ending, just has a normal ending, and you have present, which is the ending plus the e, which is usually called the hic et nunc particle, which means the here and now particle. It's used in different Indo-European forms. It means something like present, something happening presently, or something like that. So. Yeah, we can't, it doesn't appear in any of the Indo-European families. Like, you know, you only can reconstruct it in these certain persons. So it's a little weird in that it might be that the distinction between present and imperfect was sort of circumstantial in actual Indo-European. Like, you would just use this ending sometimes, apparently in the most common persons. It might, you know, we can't be sure really how. You know, it is weird.
Not making distinction between present and past.
Yeah, I mean it definitely happens. You know, there are lots of languages.
Yeah, one often does that too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, really the imperfect distinction between present and past.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not insane.
Yeah,
it's just an imperfect.
Yeah, the imperfect forms. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the perfect actually,
something that's like a pure future that English will, you build that out of the perfect, which otherwise has a past meaning.
Hmm.
Awesome.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Othum is an awesome language, I gotta say.
Yeah, it's all phonology, I hear.
Yeah, I don't know about that. If you actually like look and read the grammars, I mean, we're getting way off topic, but
no,
if you actually look in the grammar, you see a lot of like serious syntactic constraints.
Yeah.
Like, this language is not, I mean, if you go and talk to Andrew Carney and you say, I'm going to do Othum syntax, he's like, that language has no syntax, don't even bother, oddly enough.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at it,
yeah,
you see that there are actually a lot of really interesting constraints on
yeah
it. It might be partially prosodic, but
that makes it
I think
even more interesting.
Yeah, I think that there's some true blue syntax going on in a ton of Othum. It's just that
at least some.
Yeah, it's just that it's not of the English, you know.
Yeah.
It just doesn't have strict English style word order.
Yeah.
Which really shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, I know. I've been meaning to look into it myself.
Yeah.
But,
look at Ophelia Zepeda's Papago grammar. Papago is the same
thing.
Yeah. What's the term? It's a pedagogical grammar, so it's also
yeah
meant to teach you the language, but if you look through the sentences and you look at the patterns, like what she presents, like these are grammatical sentences. And you ask,
yeah,
well, wait, this is another possible ordering. Why is that not a sentence? And then she'll actually explicitly give you bad sentences saying,
oh, cool.
No,
that's
this
pretty
is like
good
garbage. Yeah.
Bad sentences are what you need.
Exactly. So yeah, so that's a thing. Tohono Othum is cool. But anyway,
yeah,
it does something similarly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it might be related to Indo-European. You never know.
Might reflect something.
Yeah.
Some
yeah
thing of
yeah, I need to look at fucking language up. Do they have classes for here? Yeah.
What?
Do they have classes for that regularly here?
They do,
yeah,
in fact. Ophelia is teaching a class this semester. And they actually have classes at the Pima County Library downtown. I have walked in on one before.
Yeah.
And some dude just stands up there and teaches you Othum.
Sweet.
And there are lots of, presumably, Othum people.
Yeah.
They are also learning their language.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah. It's really one of the coolest languages.
How many people speak it?
I think it's actually a fair number. I feel like it's endangered. I don't have an exact number. It's not like Navajo, hundreds of thousands of people, but it's...
Yeah.
Wow, Navajo is spoken by
at least 200,000 people.
Wow, that's...
it's pretty robust. I think it's actually the most robustly spoken language in, like, of the Native American languages in the U.S. Possibly in, like, North America.
Yeah.
Because some of the Mayan languages have millions of speakers, but it's pretty robust. And oddly enough, people still don't really know how it works. It's a goofy language in the sense that it's just, people just don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting language as well.
No, that's what they put, like, military code in, wasn't it?
Yeah, because they couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
It was just too goofy.
It's not a real language.
Well,
it's too real is the problem.
Yeah.
It's not English, it's
too
natural.
No straightforward head movement, that's too bad. What's that even talk about? Oh, yeah, primary endings.
Yeah, so, maybe these things at some historical point were the same tense and you just have an affix. The important thing is, like, in every descendant language, there's a very clearly a distinction between present and imperfect. There's no other language where, you know, they're different categories. You know, they're obviously two truth functionally different languages, or tenses, which are used in different ways. It's just, we reconstruct them and we find that their endings are basically the same. So they're probably related,
yeah,
aside from this little ending here. So the other interesting thing, there are so many interesting things about the tenses and stuff. Okay,
yeah.
So the other main tense is aorist, and aorist is, you usually make it out of, sometimes it'll have zero grade stems or whatever, but it's pretty much the same, you just have a secondary ending at the end.
Yeah.
Now the thing about Indo-European is that, like, basically the equation for the aorist is going to be the same as the equation for imperfect, so you might be like, oh, well then they're the same thing, why are they different? Well, it's because basically every single Indo-European verb has a slightly different way of getting a stem. So sometimes you'll have reduplication in the imperfect stem and not in the aorist, or vice versa. Sometimes you will have what's called a nasal infix. So lots of Indo-European languages, you'll have, like, you know, you'll have a root and you add in a nasal, and that's how you form the present tense. So the roots that you use are actually a little, they're all related for any particular verb. I don't think we have any good examples of secletion. But they're formed in slightly different ways. So that's where you really get the distinction between the aorist and the imperfect.
So what exactly is the... So what does the aorist mean? I've seen, like, people discuss the aorist, especially in the context of Greek, but I've never understood what its function is.
It's really just a simple past. It is perfective or whatever.
Perfective, yeah.
I always get perfect and perfective confused.
Yeah.
It's the one that doesn't imply, you know, relevance or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it's really just simple past.
Preterite-ish.
Yeah. So, yeah, preterite. Yeah. That's the other word. That's what I was looking for.
What?
Preterite.
Preterite?
Yeah.
So, you know, like in Romance languages, you have preterites and imperfects. Same thing in Indo-European. So the interesting one, so you have a third root, which is the perfect root, and this one is systematic. This is where you have reduplication basically all the time, and you have zero grades. So the first, I guess the Greek on the first page, you don't have to look back, but comes from this, so you have so you take the zero grade, you reduplicate the first consonant, and you get the zero grade here. So you have no and le. So this will give you the perfect stem. And this is very systematic in all of Indo-European perfect stems. You always pretty much have them in the same place. And they take take special perfect endings. So we call this tense perfect. It is not the perfect. We know that it is not a perfect. In Latin, it becomes a perfect. In Greek, it will become a perfect. In Sanskrit, it'll become a perfect. Everywhere, it becomes a perfect. But if you look back at Homeric Greek, or if you look back at the Rig Veda, this form has a stative reading. This is definitely a stative, not a perfect. So it's like, you know, and you can, of course, see how the semantics have changed.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the difference between
arising from the action. So originally
right.
it was
yeah.
focused on the state,
state.
And then it's focused on the action that gives rise to the state. So it's like, you know,
building a house?
Sort of, yeah. So like
the action of building a house, the actions of like doing something that results in the house being built.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of like that. I'm trying to think of a good state of verb to use. I mean, it'd be like, you know, I'm here versus I have arrived or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So originally it would have been something like I'm here, but the interpretation changes to a perfect in later Greek and later Sanskrit, and so it later means I've arrived. But it's definitely the case that this was originally stative, even though in pretty much all Indo-European languages it's not stative anymore. So the
is it? Is it something like when you say siagin big?
Yeah.
You could look at it as I am in the state of having arrived.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, sort of like that. So that's a similar example of how you get the semantics, like what the event is actually focused on changing. So yeah, that's, you know, pretty normal. And of course in some languages you actually get changes back to a state of something like that, just because the semantic categories are really ambiguous sometimes. And there are actually some, well, we'll talk about this more when we get to Hittite, because Hittite gives you good evidence of all this. So the only other tense, I mean the thing, so Indo-European, when you ask an Indo-Europeanist how many tenses that did Indo-European have, they will say present, imperfect, aorist, and, present, imperfect, aorist, and perfect. Perfect slash stative, which is the same thing. But there are a couple other categories. The one I have here is the subjunctive. And the nomenclature is the same with the case of the perfect. So what we call the subjunctive in Indo-European was not a subjunctive. It was a future tense, basically. We're pretty sure of that. Because in the oldest forms, this is used as a future tense. But in its descendant languages, it becomes a subjunctive.
When you say oldest forms, you mean like Sanskrit and...
Yeah, Sanskrit, Homeric Greek. That's usually where the evidence comes from. I mean, Hittite is older, but Hittite, we'll see, has a totally different verbal system.
Do we have different stages of Sanskrit available?
I think so, right? Sanskrit's pretty consistent.
Yeah. We have Vedic Sanskrit and others. Yeah, they're distinct, and they have different properties.
And I could have put other categories here. So there's an optative, which is sort of the actual subjunctive,
yeah.
which has a different ending and stuff like that. But a couple things, that, I mean, if you've studied something like Latin or Greek, you have to arbitrarily learn all these endings and vowel changes or whatever. The thing to keep in mind in Indo-European is that all of these tenses are nearly certainly recently grammaticalized because they all, you know, you all just... You add the same kind of endings, you'll add, you know, the difference between the future and the present is just one thematic vowel. The difference between, you know, the present, or, you know, the present and imperfect is just one extra ending, stuff like that. So at a pre-Indo-European level, there might have, again, there was probably just like what we now call the imperfect. That's all there was, just the root and you add endings and that's it. So that's the verbal system. There's one more interesting thing. Oh, yes, super important. We'll talk about voice. So Indo-European has active voice, and they have medio-passive voice. So what medio-passive means is basically everything that is not a clear transitive action. So if you studied any kind of early Indo-European language, you have passive morphology, but the passive morphology is not just used for things we think of as being passive. It's used for like verbs for walking, verbs for bodily functions, verbs for thinking, verbs for hoping. Pretty much everything that is not a transitive action will take a medio-passive ending. And in Latin you have these things called deponents, deponent verbs, which are really semantically active verbs that take passive morphology because they're relics of this kind of medial passive. So there, and on page 5 you can see the medial passive endings, whatever. And like the sort of like you know, the present, you know, the present and imperfect, you have primary and secondary endings. And the main difference between these is that the primary endings have an extra R on them, which is sort of equivalent to the E in the hiket nun particle in the primary endings. So these, the primary endings in the medial passive are probably derived from the secondary endings in the medial passive. That's one note. The second thing is, if you compare them to the perfect endings, you will realize that the medial passive endings and the perfect endings are nearly the same or extremely similar. And it's generally considered that the medial passive came from the stative verb class entirely. So originally you had, you could inflect a verb for, you know, medial passivity, and that sort of became the stative class, which became the perfect class. So this is like sort of, I don't know, this is nuts to me because it's like two totally different verbal categories, like voice and, you know, aspect, totally, I don't know. It's just, it racks your brain when you think about it. So where all of the perfect endings come from is actually the medial passive or something like that, or vice versa. Yeah, I don't know. Just think about that. It's, well, the reason it's called a medial passive is because it's such a big category. It's not just passive voice. It's basically, you know, so like I hit Ryan, that would be a transitive.
Yeah.
Very clear. You would definitely give active morphology to that. But to everything else in early Indo-European languages, you take medial passive morphology. So like if I'm saying I'm thinking about Ryan, that would be like medial passive or something in some way. Or, you know, I'm afraid of Ryan, or something like that.
So this, and we're only talking about verb morphology right now.
Yeah, this is just verb.
Not about case markings or something.
Yeah, we'll talk about this in like right now, on the next page. There's not much to say about nouns, but yeah.
You know what would be interesting, and I mean, considering that these are all reconstructions, I don't know that you could ever know this.
Yeah.
I wonder if the verbs that take, like for the verbs that take or that took medial passives, whether their like subjects had like different case markings.
Yeah.
So like dative or something.
Yeah, that's a question. I don't know how we would
ever know that.
I think in most Indo-European languages, you have a pretty consistent use as the nominative as any kind of subject.
Right.
I mean, you do have possession constructions, which would have dative.
Yeah. Or some kinds of experiencers get quirky dative.
Yeah. Because you definitely have those in, you know, Latin and stuff like that. You definitely have sort of experiencer things. But I think generally the rule in all Indo-European languages is if you have verbal inflection, it agrees with the nominative. So you will have impersonal constructions where you have like third singular and then a dative subject.
Yeah.
But I don't know if there's examples of the opposite. But it'd be worth looking up because I don't know if that doesn't exist. I feel like there's something else to say. So nouns. Let's talk about nouns. And I really just have a chart here. There's not too much to say about nouns as they are reconstructed because I guess we get to more detail as we talk about individual language families. But as we said before, so pre-Proto-Indo-European, way back up here, so I guess we've said this already, had two different noun categories, animate and inanimate. So at some point in time, these two categories they have mostly the same endings except for a nominative and accusative. So whenever you're learning an Indo-European language and you have to learn cases or whatever, you always know that the neuters will always have the same nominative, vocative, and accusative. That's just like the rule, because there's no apparent distinction between them. That it is specifically because neuter nouns have no distinction between nominative and accusative. So if you look at Hittite, if you look at really old Indo-European languages, it was impossible to use neuters as the actual grammatical subject of a verb. So in Hittite or in other languages, if you want to say something like, I don't know, the chair hit me or something like that, like the chair fell on me, you would have to say something like, it fell on me, the chair, or something like that. You have to say it like that. Apparently, neuter nouns are barred from being subjects. And
from what?
From being actual grammatical subjects. So, non-neuters are marked with what we call a nominative ending, so they take S. So this occurs only with animate things when they're subjects. And it's probably the case in Proto-Indo-European, this was a marker not of the nominative, but of ergative. Because it can only, at some pre-level, it can only occur with agents of actions and stuff like that. So way back in the day, this was probably ergative morphology. And then absolutive was just unmarked. So that's where you get the unmarked computer and stuff like that. So Persian is actually a good example of this. This is how pretty much all Indo-European languages are. When you have a plural neuter, for the same reason they can't serve as subjects, when you have a plural neuter or a plural object, or physical object, which is the subject of the sentence, you don't have to have verbal agreement. So you can be like, the books is there, or whatever. That's how Persian is, right?
Yeah, that exactly works. The books is there.
So it's the same thing in Greek, it's the same thing in, I think, classical Sanskrit. Pretty much in all of those languages, neuters do not agree with the verb. Like, it's always singular, even if the neuters are plural. So that, again, this is a holder over of the fact that they were traditionally always absolutives, and only ergative, this ergative ending actually conditioned agreement with the verb. That's probably the case.
Let me know how that goes.
Hopefully, this is just going to be fun. This last time was fun.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what it says. So we didn't quite get to the exception to all rules.
Yeah, we can talk about it next time, I guess.
Yeah, sure. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Don't worry. Yep. See ya.